Welcome to Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. This podcast is for those who are committed to thriving no matter where they are on that journey. And I say journey because thriving is not about achievement. It is not a destination. It's about engagement. It's about being energized by our life. My name is Bobby Kaler, and I'm your host. And I'm so excited to be on this journey with you. I mentioned that it's a journey, and you might find yourself anywhere along that path. You may be starting out, you may be mid-career, or you may be considering your next career. You might be an entrepreneur or a salesperson, or you may be that person who just feels like something's calling to you and it's time for a change. My mission is to provide stories that inspire us so that when challenges show up, we will choose to persist. I will also provide practical skills, perspectives, and ideas that will help us create the habits of thriving and flourishing. Because at the end of the day, it is all about providing hope, knowledge, and assurance that we can all be more fulfilled and successful if we choose. Let's dive in to today's episode. So excited to share my visit with this week's guest. He fell in love with basketball at an early age. He had his ups and downs with the sport, but his senior year in college, he was an All-American and he led the nation in scoring. He played professionally in Europe. He is an athletic director, as well as the founder of Every Level Basketball, where he trains thousands of kids every year. The context may be basketball, but trust me, what he's teaching is life skills. I hope you have a pencil and a notepad in front of you, because you're going to need it for this interview. I learned so much in our time together, and I cannot wait for you to meet him. Hey, Dennis, welcome to the show.
Bobby, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be on here with you.
Well, thank you. And when we talked the other day, you shared with me that you fell in love with basketball at a very early age, or a fairly early age, and I was kind of fascinated as to why. So can you share with us a little bit more about why you fell in love with it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think basketball has been an interwoven fabric in my life as a young child, teenager, collegiate athlete, and then obviously in my current profession as well. But, you know, the love started, and, you know, as we spoke the other day, I don't know if I loved the game of basketball. I loved the process of getting better, and I loved an opportunity to be better than my brother. I had a brother who was 11 months older than me, and he was good at everything. He was good at school. He was good at sports. And with basketball, it's such a skill-driven sport with shooting and dribbling. And I was not athletic. I couldn't jump. I wasn't fast. And I think I loved the element of, if you work hard and you're good at these things, you can have success in this game. So I think I fell in love with that part.
Yeah. So that makes it seem like it wasn't natural or something that you were born with, but something that you really worked at.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and something obviously with your line of profession of leadership development and training people how to be leaders, it's the same thing with skill acquisition. In any skill, you know, you hear these phenoms that is born piano player, or born shooter, or born hitter. They have a, born golf swing. I just don't believe in that. I mean, I think some people, I think that's a very, very small segment of the population that might be born with a specific skill or talent. But for the most part, when it comes to skill acquisition, it's required work. It's required deliberate practice, that daily grind. And I fell in love with that daily grind at an early age. Probably could have done it earlier, but I think, you know, when I was about 12 years old, I started loving the process of, you know, carving out an hour a day where I was going to have purposeful practice, where I would do game shots at game speed from game spots. And I did that same workout until I was about 28. And
wow.
I tell our players and our campers all the time, you have to fall in love with the monotony, and you have to fall in love with, you know, sometimes the boring work. You know, we always want to play 5-on-5. We always want to play in a game. But, you know, if I ever played 5-on-5 in a game or a pickup game, which I did a ton throughout my career, I always had to shoot first. I always had to get that hour in first before I would get to play.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It reminds me, and
I'm originally from the Chicago area, so this pains me to say this, but Brett Favre, you know, because he was a Green Bay Packer, so that was a natural enemy. I remember one time hearing a quote by him that he said something like, "They pay me to practice, because if they have to pay you to play, you're in the wrong profession." But the practice is where it's at.
No, it's so true, and it's so true. And there's a sense, you know, as in my later days, as I started coaching, when you get to the game, once the game starts, there's a sense of relief because all the work has already been done. All the practice has already been done. And I think, that's a great quote. I never heard that quote. I really love that. because that's where your money's made. Your money is made in your work ethic. And obviously you need to perform when the lights are bright. But the only way to do that is if you pound at your craft.
Yeah. So I have to ask you, Dennis, why did you fall in love with that process in the you can get better at it? What was it about you?
Yeah, I think there was something, you know, innate where I would celebrate, and not intentionally, I think it was unintentional, I would celebrate small wins. So, you know, in seventh grade, I was not playing on a seventh and eighth grade team. You know, I was on a good seventh and eighth grade team. My brother was in eighth grade. I was in seventh grade, and I barely played at all. And, I made it a point that in that offseason, I was going to get better, and I felt myself getting better, and I would play in a summer league, and I liked that feeling of success. So that's what drove me, is like these little small wins, you know, this feels really good. And you know, when you don't perform well at anything, whether it's your job, a sport or whatever, you don't feel good. So what drove me was, I don't want that feeling. You know, I don't want to feel like I didn't give everything I had, but I also don't want the feeling of failure. So I was like scared to death to fail. So I think it had me fall back into those fundamentals. It had me fall back into that work, because so many times what Brett Favre's talking about is like, you really can't control your performance. Mm-mm. The only thing you can control is your work. You can't control the fans, your coach, your teammates, your opponents. You can't control any of that stuff. The only thing you actually can control is the work that you put into it leading up to that performance. And I think that part, that element of control, is something that I liked. And maybe that's, you know, carried into my everyday life of wanting to control things, but I like that controllable element.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I think too, what I'm hearing there, the difference between inputs, which we control, and outputs, which we don't always control, you know? So I love that. And can you tell me what you mean by when you say deliberate practice?
Sure. So, you know, nowadays, I'm on Instagram, but I don't really know who I'm following. I'm not following a lot of people because I think it's saturated and I get lost on there. But I watch people practice now, basketball players, and it's very rare that a basketball player practices and someone is not filming them practice. Little highlight tapes and things like that. A lot of the moves that I practiced were direct reflection of what I'm going to get in the game, like exactly the same type of shot, the same type of movement, type of dribble that I'm going to get in the game. So it was very deliberate in my approach. And it was deliberate in the routine of 6 days a week, 1 hour a day. I had to get that workout in. And, I made shots. The workout that I did was predicated on making shots, not taking shots. So some days it would take me an hour and 20 minutes. Some days it might take me 50 minutes. If I'm making shots and I'm deliberate in my intentions of making shots and being successful at practice, usually that translates into the game. You know, I tell our players all the time that it's not going to be a light switch, like once the season starts or once game starts happening, that you are going to be able to turn this light switch on and really be able to focus in a game. You actually have to practice that focus one-on-zero when you're by yourself. So that's why I kind of use that term deliberate, because you have to be deliberate in your movements, in your intentions, in what you're thinking about at practice. I truly believe that that's how it translates to direct performance.
Yeah. To the point where I'm thinking about, Dennis, how that translates into the training or speaking that I do. And it's like, you put in so many hours, so many more hours than if you give a 60-minute keynote, you're putting in hours and hours because you're just going through all the motions, all, you know, what could happen here, what could happen there. So that really resonates for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I do this, you know, I don't know, but like when I speak, when I'm practicing the speech and do a routine and working on the speech, you know, I feel a sense of nerves, and that's good because I like that, because then it prepares me for the performance, because I know before I give a speech, I'm going to be nervous. So, and then once it gets rolling, then it's all good. It's just like basketball. Like before every game, I was always nervous, but once the ball tipped, you know, you're able to fall back on all the work that you put in. And then I was never nervous when the game was going on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And now, so you said when you were in the seventh grade, didn't play much. I know that that's, you know, things turned around. So how did it, how did your career end up for you in college and then later?
Yeah. So, I mean, all along the way, I guess, you know, a prerequisite to success, as you know, is failure. And time and time again, I wish it was this linear path to playing professional basketball, but it wasn't, you know, like even in high school, you know, had a great freshman year, had an okay sophomore year, had a dreadful junior year, and then had a great senior year in high school. And then I get to college, freshman year, didn't have a great year at all, ended up transferring to Ursinus College, which is a small Division III school outside of Philadelphia. And always along the way, just continued to work, And then played for a great coach, a guy named Kevin Small. And I was blessed with incredible teammates who truly played for each other and with each other. And I really benefited from playing with just amazing people that are my best friends to this day. And, you know, then it just, like I said, success breeded confidence. I was a confident player in college and ended up doing really well. My senior year was All-American, led the country in scoring. And then that allowed me to play overseas. And I played in Denmark, Poland, Italy, Spain, Austria. And even overseas, had some really great moments and some really tough moments. You know, I think that's with anyone's career, you know, I think oftentimes we look at that finished product and we think that it was all, you know, a bed of roses, but it rarely ever is in any profession.
Yep. That's so funny. I was also a huge Kansas City fan because we moved to Southwest Missouri when I was 12. And so one of my very favorite players was Tony Gonzalez. And when he got inducted into the Hall of Fame, they were interviewing him and he said something like, it's so easy to see a Hall of Fame player and think, oh, it was always easy. And he's like, those who are closest know that that road was hard.
Absolutely. I mean, no one is exempt from failure. No one's exempt from the games where you feel that game, you feel terrible. After that season, you feel terrible. Like in any sport, you're always going to have that. And that's what we tell our players all the time is that you truly have to practice your response to failure. And, you know, we talked about it earlier, it's the only person that can control that is yourself. And it's not a light switch that you're going to be able to turn on. So like when you're failing in that 1 hour workout or that 2 hour practice, you have to practice that response to failure. So then when it does happen in the game, you are able to respond positively and continue to fight and continue to play.
Yeah. Okay. So that you just hooked me with that. What do you mean practice your response to failure?
Yeah. So, you know, I talk so much about controlling the controllables and, you know, Simon Sinek is a great speaker. I'm sure you know him.
Oh, yeah.
He's incredible. And I use so many of his philosophies with our student athletes, with our campers, with people that I train. And, you know, he talks about do not be a victim of the circumstance, rather be an architect of the response. So we all have tough circumstances. We're living in one right now, you know, and, you know, my friend told me the other day, you got to be a warrior, not a worrier during these times. And, you know, this circumstance, this scenario that we're faced with the COVID pandemic is very, very tough. You know, we certainly could allow ourselves to be a victim of this circumstance. But just like these circumstances, they happen all the time in sport. And instead of being that victim, you have to be the architect of your response, of how you respond to it, of how you fight through it and battle through it. And I think that truly separates the good from the great. I think it truly separates your experience too. Like when you look back on your experience, whether it's sport, business, life, if you can figure out how to do that and thought stoppage and things like that, I truly think that it separates, you know, an average experience to a great experience because you can truly learn from it.
Yeah. I love that. The architect of your own response. And I know, Dennis, that you run camps and you're an athletic director, and we'll get to that a little bit later too, but how do you teach your students to do that?
Yes. So what we do is, you know, the best way to do it, honestly, is through observation. So when I'm able to observe them on the field hockey field or on the basketball court, on the football field, you know, I love going to games. It's the favorite part of my day and going to practice, you know, from 3 to 5 p.m. when I'm able to just leave my office and go watch players perform. It's the best part of my day. So the best way to teach that is through observation. So I observe, Next day I'll meet with them, talk about, you know, what were you thinking after that mistake? How did you respond to that? How do you think you respond to that mistake? And I usually use a metric, you know, 1 to 10. I always take 7 out of it because it's a safe number. And I say, give me a 10 if you responded well, give me a 1 if you didn't respond well. And, you know, if they say 6, how can we get you to an 8? How can we get you to a 9? And what does that look like? You know, what are things that you can do? We talk a lot about mistake rituals. So when you make a mistake, have a ritual, and it could be a quarter of a second or 2 second ritual that you use. One thing that I like to use when I would make mistakes, I would wipe the bottom of my sneakers. And you know, that was a symbolic gesture for me that I was wiping the mistake away and I'm ready to move on to the next play. But it's also
powerful.
Yeah, it's also a symbolic gesture to my teammates, because they knew that, because I shared that with them. You know, that they knew that I was moving on, you know, because if teammates think that you're down and you're upset and you're pining over your last decision or your mistake, they're not going to pass you the ball. They're not going to trust you. You know, so I try to get our student athletes to work together on defining what failure looks like, defining on what a bad response looks like, and defining what a good response looks like. And part of that good response is a mistake ritual. You know, we have team mistake rituals, individual mistake rituals, and working through those kind of things, I think are tangible concepts that, you know, it's the same thing with like mental training and visualization. There's no guarantee that any of this will work all the time, but there's a guarantee if you don't work on it, you're not going to get better at it.
That's right. There is that guarantee.
You know, so if we neglect it, we're not going to get better. And as coaches, we often put those conversations off. And as business leaders or CEOs or someone that you're leading, I think oftentimes we put those conversations off about failure or about disappointment, and the recipient, your constituent or the person you're leading or your teammate, they fill it in with negativity. I think that's the worst part. Yeah.
Because you're absolutely right. The negativity, the judgment, and then that just becomes like its own downward spiral that becomes worse than the original mistake.
You got it. Yes. Because they're in their mind that, oh my gosh, the coach must think I'm terrible. My teammate must think I'm terrible. My boss, he hasn't said a word to me in a week. He must think I'm an awful whatever, you know, and they just, we as humans, we fill it in with negativity.
Yep. We internalize it. So the kids that you're teaching this to, how do they respond?
It's a great question. You know, I think they like it. You know, I think it's, I wish I did this stuff when I was in high school. In college, you know, I think that they enjoy the conversations. I think they enjoy the challenge. Most of the players and student athletes that I'm working with have a growth mindset and want to get better. Mm-hmm. And as you know, with leading and leadership development and all, you know, that line of work, everything starts with a relationship. So before I can mentor them or help them in the context of being a better player, better athlete, better teammate, more mentally tough person, you have to have a relationship. And so I try to do that on the front end, forge relationships with as many student athletes and campers and players as possible, so that when we're trying to mentor them and help them through tougher times, they're receptive, you know, they're open to it.
Yeah. That's just, you know, hitting the nail on the head right there. Without the relationship, without the trust, they're not going to be receptive. I see this all the time with managers, and it's like, you have to have that relationship. And I always think about it this way. If we want someone to trust us and we want them to be vulnerable, because when you're coaching, we're asking them to be vulnerable about where their shortcomings are, or, you know, like their response, that type of thing. If they do not trust us, they will not be vulnerable. They just won't share.
I love it. I love it. And you know, that comes from, you know, the best way to do that, in my opinion, that, in, you know, in my own experience, has been to also demonstrate vulnerability. So
yeah,
you know, the difference between what you call, you know, what you call a manager and a leader. I think a true leader is able to demonstrate vulnerability, because then it puts you and the person you're leading or your teammates that or your athletes that you're coaching, puts you on the same level. And it's, you know, idea of servant leadership. You know, I think them, and I tell our coaches all the time, ego is the enemy in coaching. You know, like, I want you to be a confident coach. I want you to know and have, you know, knowledge of the game and drills and skills and all those things. But I also want you to understand that, like, you don't always have to know everything, and you can show that vulnerability, because then it creates a sense of ownership on the part of the player.
Yeah.
You know, instead of saying, like, you need to buy into this philosophy, you got to buy into my offense, you got to buy into my defense, you got to buy into my core values, allow them to take ownership of it And I just think it works a lot better. Instead of buy-in, we preach ownership as much as we can.
Yeah. And I love that about the ego, because it is, it's kind of the enemy of vulnerability. And it's kind of one of the enemies of receptivity as well. That's great.
We all have it. And
I say,
well, our coaches, you got to figure out what your ego is, because we all have it. And you need to figure out where it's rooted, because it's going to come out when you coach. It's going to come out when you lead. And when it comes, its head, it's ugly. And it's going to be stemming from when you were a high school athlete or when you were a college athlete, that you were treated a certain way. And all of a sudden, because you were treated that way, it triggers your ego to treat student athletes that way. So it's so important to define what that shortcoming is, because ultimately in all of us, human nature, it's going to come out.
Yeah. What that sounds like a little bit is getting to maybe, you know, like a blind spot. How do you help them identify that?
Yeah, sure. Student athletes or coaches?
The coaches.
Yeah. It's not easy, especially because, you know, I've been athletic director for 5 years, and you know, we have coaches that have been coaching for 20 or 30 years.
Oh boy.
And, you know, not to beat a dead horse, but it goes back to the relationship. You know, like if I forge a good enough relationship with the coach, you know, when we sit down and we talk about those shortcomings or we talk about those areas of improvement, my boss, the head principal, his name's Sam Verano, is a terrific leader, terrific mentor of mine. You know, he told me when I first started in this role, he said, look, allow a parent, a player, a coach, allow them to be upset with the decision, but don't allow them to be upset with the way you delivered it. And that really stuck with me. I use it every day. So when I'm talking to a coach about their shortcomings, you know, obviously everyone knows a criticism sandwich and those kind of things, you know, so much of it is how you deliver it and how you present it through the contextual lens of, look, you're doing a great job. You can do all these things. You bring so much to the table. If you're able to do this and check this part of it, and I think the way you shape it interpersonally, it's not just about coaching, but it's who they are as people, you know, especially with the ego piece and especially with areas of improvement with coaching. You know, it's rare that I talk to a coach about X and O or practice plans. Most of it is about interpersonal stuff.
Wow. That's amazing. And I love what you're teaching the kids too, because like this is, yeah, it's in the context of sports, but these are life skills.
100%. And that's what gets me up in the morning. Like, you know, no disrespect to the profession, you know, but if I was scheduling buses and scheduling officials and doing that every day, I don't know if I'd be excited, but I'm excited about the leadership development. I'm excited about, hey, in 4 years, you're going to look different. You're going to feel different. You're going to think differently about yourself. That's the stuff that really wakes me up in the morning, gets me excited, because sport is such a great vehicle for life. And, you know, very few people are going to make money, you know, at their sport, and very few people are going to get paid, you know, to go to school. So if that's the case, how can we truly use sport as a vehicle for personal, social, emotional development, you know, while they're in high school?
Yeah, that is awesome. And I want to go back to one thing that you said earlier, because you mentioned it a couple times, Dennis, around, you know, you had failures along the way. You learned how to, like, it seems like, embrace those. Did you ever feel discouraged by any of the failures?
Oh, 100%. You know, I think one of the greatest failures I've ever experienced was my junior year of high school. I talk to our student athletes and our campers about this all the time. So I am playing at LaSalle High School in the Catholic League, which is, you know, one of the best leagues in Pennsylvania, one of the best leagues on the East Coast, a very good sports league. And so I'm starting on the team. I'm averaging like 12, 13 points a game. We're 10-2 and we're having a great season. My brother's on the team. He's averaging like 15 points a game, but I'm cool with it. I'm just so happy to be playing and starting and adding value to the team. And, you know, my best friend, who's still my best friend to this day, he was suspended from the team, and he came back on the team January 1st. He was suspended for the first semester. So he comes back. First game, I remember we were playing at Father Judge. I start, I don't play very well. He comes in, subs in for me. He kills it. He's a very, very good basketball player. Still to this day, an amazing basketball player. His name's Brian Horgan. Brian, if you're listening, you know this story. so he, and then the next game I started again. And you know, very minutes diminished. And then the next game I came off the bench, and probably about the fourth game in, I really didn't play at all. And I didn't play the rest of the season. So I sat the bench the entire season. There were so many nights I'd come home crying to myself. Like, I really kind of kept it to myself. My parents knew I was hurting, but I was crushed. I mean, still to this day, like, thinking about that, I'm 38 years old. You know, I'm 17 at the time. It's still like, I got,
it still hurts.
It still hurts. And, you know, but I look at that and did I embrace that failure? Absolutely not. You know, that was 2 months of just anguish and pain. But what I credit my parents, because there was never a moment where they said, Dennis, you need to go talk to the coach. Dennis, we're going to talk to the coach. You should be playing. You should be doing this. They always said to me, you need to do something more. There's something you're not doing or that you're not capable of doing that player's playing over you. And it wasn't a lot. Like, they probably said that to me 2 times in 2 months. That was it. I didn't need anything else. So that off season, I pushed myself so hard. And again, like, I want to say that I love this. Basketball is my life. Like, if anyone, you ask anyone, this is my life. It's my business. It's my passion. But I look at the deep-rooted part of my relationship with basketball, and I think even in that moment, that whole offseason, I wanted to prove that head coach wrong. And, you know, I'm mm-hmm. friends with the head coach to this day. He was at my wedding, and he's a great guy. But I wanted to prove him wrong so bad that I worked even harder in that offseason and, you know, ended up starting, was all Catholic, and scored 15 points a game and just had a great senior year. And I'll never forget, throughout college, my senior year, when I was scoring a ton of points, you know, our high school coach, he didn't come to see us play because he was always coaching. And he came to this one game, was at Haverford College. And I had 30 points in the first half.
Oh, my goodness.
I think I ended up with 45 or 48 points or something. And it was crazy because, you know, at the end of the game, he's like, that's amazing. And the assistant coach, like, kind of came up to me, the assistant high school coach. He came too, and he came up to me like on the side, and he's like, you know, it just seemed like every shot you made, you were trying to like prove him wrong. And I was like, that's not the case. You know, I'm 4 years removed from high school, but he was on to something because I definitely was motivated to prove that coach wrong. So to answer your question, I don't think I embraced it well at all. When I was January, February, March of that season, I allowed it to affect my game. I allowed it to affect. It didn't affect my work, but it definitely affected my confidence. And I never wanted that to happen again. So that really, that pain pushed me throughout the course of my career.
Yeah, that is, I've often thought about it, you know, failure or adversity, it can also be fuel.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it was for you. The other thing, Dennis, that I have to comment on is I love the response of your parents. You know, that was great role modeling.
Incredible. And I always say, you know, in my profession now, like if there's 20, you line up 20 parents, 15 parents probably get it wrong. And it's mm-hmm. really in the context of sport. And it's whether they are living through their child, whether they are blaming it on the coach, whether they're blaming it on other student athletes, whether they're blaming it on a trainer, whatever it might be. And there's no data behind that for our listeners, but that is just my gut. 15 out of 20 get it wrong. There's only a small segment of parents that truly understand the process. Like, this is their process. This is their journey. And, you know, if you want to step in and constantly make excuses for your play, for your kid, they're never going to learn how to get through failure or how to grow and all those things. But no, I talk to my parents about it still to this day. And I thank them for it, that you got, whether it was intentional or unintentional, they stayed out of the way. They loved me, supported me. And, you know, it was just, they were wise beyond their years. Cause I mean, parents back then were probably as crazy as they are now. I just didn't, my parents were really involved in that, you know, but they're nuts now. So it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Here's what happens. It buffers that failure. Mm-hmm. So when you buffer that failure, you never feel it. Here's how the failure gets buffered. When the kid's not playing. So if I was in that situation and my parents were saying, Dennis, this is ridiculous. This coach has it out for you. You should be playing. Dennis, you got to go talk to him. We're going to talk to the athletic director. Here's what happens in my mind. I conceptualize that failure. And I'm like, okay, yeah. That builds in an excuse for me. So then I don't need to work. And so it's so counterproductive for the kid because it buffers that failure, dampens the sting.
Yep. And I think, oh gosh, that is spot on. I mean, because I've thought about that many times. And you're right, when we buffer the failure, we're also cheating the person out of the learning and out of the opportunity.
100%. You know? And you can do it in a way. That's why I love working for my boss. Like, you can give very critical feedback, very honest, transparent feedback in a way where they accept it, you know? And, you know, and I think that's key for great leaders.
Yep. I'll never forget, that just triggered a memory. When I was in high school, I competed in speech and debate. And I remember there was one, it was one competition I was in, and I made it like to the district level. And that was really great. And my mom was there, and I lost at districts. And I think the next level would have been state. And I was bummed. Of course I'm bummed. And my mom handled it so well. She's like, because afterwards she's like, hey, listen, I'm your mom. So of course I think you're the best. And she said, you know, which if, hey, that's nice. And she goes, but I wonder if the other person won and it was valid, why do you think she won? And that was just such a great question. Cause I'm like, oh, my delivery was good. My speech was not as good as the other girls, like the way that she wrote it. And so that just made me become a student of what did she do to craft that speech and what can I learn from it?
That's awesome. That's awesome. I mean, that's truly what it's about. And that's where the growth mindset kicks in. Oh. Like if you don't have the ability to be self-aware like that, self-awareness is huge, because without that self-awareness, you're exactly right. You would have never have learned to do that, to push yourself in that direction.
No, it might have felt good for a while that my mom was, you know, buffering or coddling or whatever. But the next year I entered even a bigger competition and I won that. And I know that I would not have won that next competition had it not been for that failure.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
You know, want to shift gears a little bit to, because we've alluded to it, you're an athletic director, you've got the camps. Give us a picture of everything that you've got going on.
Yeah, it's a lot, you know, and I talk about, you know, the embracing the squiggle. So, you know, I think in our world oftentimes, and I think we're steering away from it a little bit, but there's this idea that, you know, you go to high school, you go to college, you major in whatever it is, and then you work in that profession for 30, 35 years, you retire and you live a good life, blah, 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 blah. It's this linear path. And, you know, I've always kind of squiggled a little bit and I've tried to embrace the squiggle. It's been very nonlinear for me. You know, I went overseas and came back, and then I taught for 2 years in high school. Then I coached and taught in college. And then I jumped back and was an athletic director. All the while doing that, I've always kept that burning passion for basketball in these camps that we've run. So we're in our 17th summer this summer running our basketball camp. And it's very different this year than any other year. So, you know, aside from the day job of athletic director, I'm a 10-month employee at the school district, which is, I'm blessed to be able to do that. Most athletic directors are 12 months. So I'm 10 months there at the school. And then in the summertime is all basketball camp. And I'm still working for the school pretty much every day, doing an hour of emails every single day. But, you know, we're doing a basketball camp all summer long. We had about 2,000 kids last summer.
Wow.
And, you know, we would probably be a little bit over that this summer if COVID didn't hit. But, you know, that is really just my passion. It's so much fun. I love working with the kids. And I find I find equal amount of joy working with our staff and seeing our staff grow and working through all the concepts that you and I have talked about, you know, for the last half hour, working that with our staffs and seeing in a small amount of time, you know, in a couple of weeks, seeing them grow and breaking down the comfort zone and demonstrating vulnerability. Because ultimately if they demonstrate vulnerability and they demonstrate a sense of, you know, self-confidence, then the kid will take risks. Even in a 5-day camp, we'll see that growth, which I really love. So I got the camps. I do 10-week programs during the fall, winter, and spring on Sundays. I work kids out for about 2 hours, which is just enough to get my basketball fix and just enough to stay married.
it's a good balance.
Yeah, it's a great balance. So we got that going on. We started our podcast just like you started when we started a couple months ago, right when the pandemic hit, Shoot to Make podcast, which has been a ton of fun with pretty much all basketball players and coaches. start where I would like to, my next step, which I'm excited about, and it's not really fully conceptualized per se, but I want to start a small sports agency for overseas basketball players. So every single year I try to help basketball players, guys that graduate college or just out of college, you know, get jobs overseas using my contacts that I have from overseas. So my next step would, I would love to make that more formative and make that into something, because I, at the core, I just want to help players have an experience that I had. And if it turns into something, great. If it doesn't, I know I'm going to have fun doing it.
Yeah, but that's terrific.
Yeah, so got that going on. I got three beautiful children and a beautiful wife that keep me very busy as well. And that's a ton of fun as well.
That's cool. And your kids are fairly young.
Yeah, Caroline's 6, Abigail's 5, and Jack is 2. And just incredible how different they are as people. And it's just, it really is a blast every day. I mean, I love it all. I love the diapers. I love, you know, I don't love getting up in the middle of the night, but like, I love the tough days, the good days, the fun day. It's just a blast. It's the best gift ever.
That is awesome. And now, speaking of squiggling, didn't you, so I think when we talked last time, didn't you say that like you'd moved, you're supposed to be building a house or moving, you moved into your in-laws maybe, and then COVID hit. So you started Zoom clinics in the living room?
Yeah. So yeah, it's pretty incredible. And I've always heard people talk about, you got to pivot, you know, you got to pivot in business. And I've squiggled. I don't know if I've never had like intentional pivots per se, especially not in my business. So like our camp, you know, it's an LLC, all that stuff. And we've really worked to make it what it is. But that's really been every year, kind of work really hard, market, give, you know, make an impact in the community. And it just kept growing. Like I never really had to make any business decisions or pivots. But for this, when this COVID hit, you know, we had a spring camp scheduled, you know, every Sunday, that Sunday clinic that we had to cancel. And then obviously our camps. You know, so one of the things that we try to do, that I try to do in the business is to give more than you get. There's a guy named Gary Vaynerchuk who is he's an interesting follow on social media. He talks about 51-49, that you might have to give 51 to get back 49. And I think it's not, you know, sometimes it's give 95 to get 5 back. And certainly parenting is, you know, 99, you get back 1, but, I've always used that as a mantra for our business. So like I do a ton of free clinics, a ton of free lessons in hopes, you know, in hopes to provide a great experience for those kids, but also, hey, if I do a good job, I'm going to get it back in the long run for our camp. So when COVID hit, I started doing free Zoom workouts, literally in my in-laws' living room. Shout out to my in-laws. I don't even think you guys know I'm doing this. I'm doing it in their living room, and I would move the couches over. I would do them Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and I would, you know, my wife would be on a work call, and I'd put the kids in the basement and give them some videos to watch and say, hey, just give me 40 minutes. And it was really cool. You know, I started out with just sending it out to my own like camper list, you know, which is extensive list with kids that have been to our camps or clinics or whatever. And so I just started a random Excel document. I would just add emails every day, whoever wanted to join. And, you know, we ended up training over 9,000 kids in a 2-month period. So we did 24 workouts and trained over 9,000 kids. And, you know, that kind of funneled into not being able to do any of our big camps in June. So we did virtual camps. And what that looked like was I wasn't going to do those in the living room. My father's an electrical contractor, and he has this warehouse where he has his like trucks and you know, tools and things like that. It's a big warehouse. So I set up shop there. I put a portable basketball net there. I have my laptop, and I hardwired the Ethernet cable to the telephone. I don't know anything about computers or technology or whatever. I'm just excited to be on the Zoom here today, and it's not cutting me out.
But, it's always a good thing.
It's always a good thing. So we did 3 weeks of Zoom camps, and we had, you know, close to almost 400 kids. And so that was really cool. And it's not that you're keeping, not that I'm keeping score, but it's nice to be able to look back and say, you know, you give that much during a tough time. You know, I'm entertaining, I'm working with these kids 3 days a week during a really tough time for everybody. And, you know, it pays off in the long run for sure. You know, it ended up all working out.
That is so, when you told me that originally, I was blown away. I told my husband, I'm like, you're not even gonna believe this. That's being a warrior. That's for sure.
Yeah. It was really cool. And there was a couple days too, where, you know, I'm moving the couch, I'm moving these lamps, and my wife's like, you know, can't you just charge like $1 or $5? Cause there'd be 500 kids on the call. And, wow. You know, I think it worked out. Obviously I felt like it was a really good 30-minute workout, but in a time where people had no human interaction and kids had no human interaction,
yeah,
in the course of a 30-40 minute workout, if you had your name on your profile, I was shouting you out. And I think kids just like to hear that acknowledgement during a really tough time.
Yeah. The connection's so important for everyone. And I think the kids really probably missed it because they're so used to being at school and in sports and all that kind of stuff. That's awesome.
100%. And I just pray that we are able to get back to traditional education here in September, because I think it's touch and go every day here in our area.
Yep. Who knows? I mean,
yep.
There's one other thing I have to ask you about, because, and I told you this when we talked earlier, but I was on your website. You've got a video there that I thought was phenomenal, the All In. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think you hear it all the time. You know, if you watch sports, they're constantly talking about he's all in or this team's all in. And, you know, for us and what it's one of our core values at Souderton. One of our four core values is going all in. And when we talk about going all in, you know, we want you to give every ounce of your fiber to what you love to do. Like, find out what you love to do and go all in, whatever it is, whether it's football, tennis, field hockey, golf, piano, guitar, give everything you possibly can to that. And the two things that hold people back from going all in are they care what other people think and they're afraid to fail. Mm-hmm. So the caring what other people think is really tough, because at the high school and collegiate level, more so the high school level, we see it all the time. So if I'm going to work really hard, like my junior year, if that second part of that junior year, if I was going to bust it every day and work really hard and still not play in the game, we call that going all in. Like, regardless of the outcome, you are still going to grind and you are still going to fight. So many kids care what other people think and they don't want to be that try-hard or that do-gooder and still not be the best player or the starter. And it holds them back from their true potential. We see it in school all the time. Like, you know, I got an 80 on a test. You know, I'm good at math. I just didn't study. You know, like, mm-hmm. I didn't give everything I possibly could, but I'm smart. You know, like, they don't want to give everything they possibly can because they care what other people think. And the second piece is something that we've talked about, you know, this whole time, is just, you know, we're afraid to fail. Like, give everything you possibly can and relinquish to the process. Don't worry about the results. It's a hard thing to do. You know, it's a very hard thing to do in our society. But you can't be afraid to fail. That's going to take you away from going all in on your passion or whatever you love to do.
Yeah. I loved that. And I especially loved in the video, and you touched on it here too, we say, well, we're not all in, because then it's like almost a built-in excuse. So if we do fail, well, yeah, but I wasn't really giving it my best. I loved that.
Yeah. We create those things. We create those barriers. We create those, you know, almost roadblocks in our mind, and they happen really quickly. Like, when that thought comes into your mind, when you create that space of an excuse, mm-hmm. Tell our players, like, you have to really acknowledge it to try and stop it. And in order to stop that thought, it might take you 30 seconds, but if you continue to chip away at that thought stoppage of making that excuse, then you start being able to block it quicker, and then it starts, you know, you be rid of your character. And, you know, I think that's truly what, you know, personal development is figuring out, you know, what you're good at, what you're not good at, but also what is detracting you from your goals and just be ridding that of your personality.
Yeah. It's like you practice it until it becomes a habit.
You got it.
Dennis, this has been great. Where can people find you if they want to learn more about the camps or your podcast, any of that stuff?
Sure, absolutely. Our podcast is on Spotify. It's Shoot to Make Podcast. I think it's on other outlets too. I don't know how it gets there, but I use Anchor, and it just somehow gets to Spotify. I think
it's magic.
It's incredible. So Shoot to Make Podcast, Instagram, we're at Every Level B-Ball, at Every Level B-Ball. And then Facebook, I'm just at Dennis Stanton, LinkedIn, Dennis Stanton, Twitter, at Every Level B-Ball as well.
Nice, nice. And what is the podcast? What is it about?
Yeah, so very similar to the things that we're talking about here. The podcast is basically, it's a platform, it's a playbook for coaches and athletes to learn from the journeys of other coaches. Nice. So basically, you know, our mutual friend, Pat Carroll, when he was on, it was incredible. He talked about his high school journey, his college journey, his professional journey. And like you articulated earlier about Tony Gonzalez, he talked about failure and talked about how you handled failure and what that looked like and how it shaped your success. So it's basically about personal journey in the context of sport.
Wow. That sounds like my kind of podcast, I got to tell you, because I love sports.
I can tell. Yeah, great quotes. I'm stealing them.
Go ahead. Pat's always giving me a hard time. He's like, oh my gosh, we could talk sports all the time. And I'm like, that is fine with me. That is totally great. That is awesome. Any final words of wisdom for people who might be listening about, you know, any part of the journey or lessons that you've learned?
Sure, sure. And I think it's easy for me to sit back here. I'm not some wise sage, because what I'm about to say is something that I work on every day, but truly relish that journey, relish the process, because it's incredible how quickly life goes. And I try to stop myself so many times and realize how old my kids are right now and how quickly that went. So I just try to step back as much as possible and play present and be present. And that is certainly something for me that I need to work on every single day. So I'll challenge all of our listeners also to work on that and to be present and truly relish in that process of whatever you love to do and whatever part of your life is presenting that journey for you.
That is great advice. And it can be difficult, to your point, because sometimes we get really caught up in whatever's going on.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow. Dennis, thank you so much for joining. This has been awesome.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. It's an honor to be on here with everything you've done in your career. It's an honor that you chose me to be on here, and I'm looking forward to listening to Pat's and listening to some other ones.
Very cool. I appreciate it, and thank you.
You got it. Let's definitely stay in touch.
That sounds great. I was scribbling notes as fast as I could during that interview. I hope that you felt like that was a real shot in the arm. I know that I did. Here are some of my standout takeaways. Number one, skill acquisition and mastery is about consistent and deliberate practice, and you have to fall in love with the practice. Number two, practice your response to failure. What I particularly loved about that is that you don't have to be a victim of your response to failure. You can be the architect of it. Related to that, Dennis talked about having a mistake ritual so that you can move on and put it behind you instead of judging it and feeling bad about it. So often, failure sticks with us because we judge it instead of simply accepting it for what it is. It's just a part of the process. Number three. As a leader and coach, you need to demonstrate vulnerability because ego is the enemy of effective coaching. I've coached more than 3,000 people in my career, and this one stands out to me because that is so true. Vulnerability, not ego, is king. Number four, when we try to buffer the failure of another person, whether that is our child or a member of our team or a member of our family, we cheat them out of the growth that can come from feeling a failure. Number five, sometimes a failure sets us up for our next big success. Number six, and I love the imagery, embrace the squiggles, right? Our lives and our journey, they're not always linear, and that's okay. Embrace it. Number seven, give more than you get. Number eight, be a warrior, not a worrier. Number nine, choose to be all in. Dennis said that he believes that there are two main things that keep people from deciding to be all in. Number one, caring about what other people think. And number two, being afraid to fail. He said that to be all in and work past these two barriers, you need to relinquish yourself to the process and don't worry about the result. Focus on and relish the process. I had to work really hard to keep my takeaways under 10. I was scribbling notes the whole time. If you found this podcast helpful, please consider subscribing as well as leaving us a 5-star review below. Also, if you know someone who could benefit from the podcast and the message that we are spreading, please tell them about the podcast and share it with them. Again, this has been the Unyielded Podcast, and I believe that thriving isn't a destination. It is a process. It is an evolution where we are continuing to expand who we are. It's how we grow into who we were meant to be and how we become our very best selves. And I believe it's how we make the world a better place. My life's work is to change the world for the better, one life at a time. I hope that you'll help me do that by sharing your work.